This is Think Out Loud on OPB and KLCC. I'm Dave Miller. The Oregon Symphony is premiering a new series of concerts tomorrow night. It's called Sounds of Home. It explores big issues that are more likely to be seen on cable TV or on the front page of a newspaper than in a concert hall. Think homelessness and the environment, or immigration, which is a theme for the program this weekend. The first concert has a special resonance for Carlos Calamar, the music director of the symphony. He is a child of immigrants and has emigrated twice himself. Calamar joins me now to talk about this series and his life. Maestro Calamar, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What's the idea behind this Sounds of Home series?
Actually, we looked at what we are doing on our day and age in concert halls, and we thought it's a great idea to expand that because we are presenting very interesting programs that actually matter to our society, but we don't involve societal problems, let's say issues, into our programming. And we, here in Portland, Oregon, we are the first orchestra ever to tackle such a theme in a concert by having commissioned a playlet on one side and music accompanying that playlet on the same topic, which is immigration in this case of the weekend.
A playlet, meaning a short play.
It's a short play about immigration.
What's it been like to actually work with a playwright and a composer on a world premiere?
Well, in this case, the composer came first because we had the pleasure of premiering a little piece by Chris Rogerson last season, and the piece was wildly successful here. So we said, "Hey, we need to work with you again." At that time, we already knew that we want to do something in regards to Sounds of Home. And then we looked for somebody to write it. And we were very, very lucky to find Deepika Guha, who, again, is an immigrant. So essentially, we are presenting a program that is around immigration. And pretty much everybody involved, with the exception of the composer, who is American, everybody involved is an immigrant. So Deepika Guha comes from India. She wrote the playlet. Composers, George Gershwin, second-generation American, comes from immigrant. Sergei Prokofiev had to immigrate during his life. Arnold Schoenberg definitely had to immigrate during his life because of the Nazis. Kirill Gerstein, my piano soloist in this concert, is Russian, who emigrated in parts to the United States and lives now in Germany. I myself was born in South America, in Montevideo, in Uruguay, emigrated to Vienna, spent the next 38 years of my life there, and I happily live now in the United States. You look around on the stage when you see the Oregon Symphony and you understand they come from very different parts of the world. I turn around, look at the audience. It's a reflection of society, and we just wanted to do something that actually is reflective of the society nowadays.
Let's listen to a little bit from of this world premiere, this collaboration with Deepika Guha. This is Chris Rogerson. Let's have a listen. And this is actually from a rehearsal of the orchestra last night. So as you said, this is music that is also going to be – it's going to be performed alongside or with a playlet, a short play. So what's the audience actually going to see?
Well, in order to see or to hear, you have to come, of course, to the Anna Aline Schnitzer concert. Sorry, I had to pitch it.
Yeah.
I think the great thing is – so it's a playlet, and parts of the playlet are descriptive. This is going on. The going on part of the playlet is going to be spoken over the music. And then when the music gets silent, we are going to see different scenes. Everything evolves around one immigrant who is in the room and what happens.
Let's turn a little bit to your story. You gave us the short version. My understanding is that your parents are both from Austria. They ended up in Uruguay having fled the Nazis in the 1930s. How did they get away?
As everybody who is has Jewish blood in their veins, they barely did. My mother actually left Austria in 1938 with her parents. My mother at that time was 10 years old, a kid. My father's story was maybe a little more dramatic and more interesting because my father left after Reichskristallnacht in Europe, also 38, and went, although he was 19 years old already, he left with one of the last Kindertransporte, ended up with his cousin in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands. My father enlisted on a Norwegian freighter. His cousin wasn't as lucky and was killed by the Nazis. My father sailed the world for 1.5 years.
How old was he?
He was 19 when he left and 21 when he returned to land, which was to go to La Paz, Bolivia, where, through other channels, his two brothers and his mother had ended up. Why Bolivia? It's very simple, because at that time there were people who just had to flee, and you go wherever you are allowed to get in. And Bolivia at that time just let a certain contingent of refugees into the country. My parents met there, fell in love there, married in La Paz, Bolivia, decided not to have a family in Bolivia, emigrated again to Montevideo in Uruguay, quieter country, had two boys. I'm the younger one. And when the two boys wanted to go to university, it was clear they have to go to university somewhere else other than Uruguay. In my case, it's very obvious I wanted to become a musician. In Uruguay, great music, but not classical. It's not their forte, so I wanted to go to Europe.
How much did your parents talk about their families or their experiences to you when you were growing up?
My mother did talk very, very little. I think that has mostly to do with her lack of recollection. She was a kid. My father talked quite a lot. And the great thing about that for us as a family was my father left an entire book of letters that he and his older brother wrote to each other, starting with immigration 1938. They wrote to each other until both of them died.
What a treasure. And you have the both sides.
I have the collection of both sides. And the funny thing is that back in 1938, there were many people, including in the family of my father, who simply believed, oh, this is not so bad. We are going to survive. As in 3 years, it's going to be over and we're going to live a happy life. And none of them survived.
Before this show, we asked you if there was a piece of music that you remember from early in your life that made an impression on you. You told us it's from the opera Hansel and Gretel. What do you remember? I mean, when did you first hear this?
I think I was around 5, maybe 6 years old, and my parents took me. It was an outdoor venue in Montevideo in Uruguay where they played this opera. I remember very little, aside from the fact that it was summer and the bugs were really a pain in the neck. And I also remember that, as every other kid in this opera, you have to be really scared of the evil witch. But later, my parents realized I'm so interested in classical music. I love to go to shows like that, even to concerts, that barely a year later they asked me, do you want to learn an instrument? And at that time, being a six-year-old kid, I only knew the name of two instruments, literally, which was the piano and the violin. So the chances were 50-50, and I picked the violin.
Let's have a listen to the beginning of that opera of Hansel and Gretel by Engelbert Humperdinck. This is performed by the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra.
Rose, liebe Suse, was raschelt im Strom? Die Gänse gehen barfuß und haben kein Schuh. Der Schuster.
What are you hearing? I wish people could watch you. As soon as the music started, your arms went up in the air like a very elegant bird. What do you hear when you hear this?
Well, I hear memories. Aside from that, this opera by Humperdinck is based mostly on children's songs. So I know all the children's songs, and being a father myself, some of these songs come very easily to my lips because I sang them to my children.
That's so interesting. I was assuming you were going to talk from the perspective of a conductor, but what you're talking about is much more personal.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, but this piece in particular has something to do with kind of who I am as a person. Because, sure, I had the tremendous honor of conducting this opera several times. It's an absolute joy for a conductor. But matter of fact, at home, as we speak, I have my little boy, Claudio, who is 10 months old, and I have also in pre-kindergarten my other boy, who is not even 3. And when they come home, I will end up here and there singing something to them. And trust me, it's from this opera.
Huh. Today?
Today. Yeah, it's all the time. There are later in this opera, in the second act, there is a song. And trust me, if I would have my boys here and I would start to sing, they would smile. Not only because Daddy sings so poorly, it's because they recognize the tune.
What was it like for you to start playing violin? 50-50 chance, violin or piano. Violin is smaller and cheaper, I imagine, which maybe didn't hurt for your parents. But when you started, what did it feel like?
I think it felt fairly foreign because I had the same idea as every kid has, which is, oh, I'm going to pick this up and within an hour I'm going to be high fits. And it doesn't really work like that. It's at the beginning, violin playing, it requires a lot of patience, which for a six-year-old you might not really have.
It really requires patience for your parents, I assume, who are hearing the sounds you're making.
Yeah, the great thing about starting to play the piano immediately sounds wonderful. The violin, it takes a while until you figure it out.
It's a steep learning curve.
Yeah, but given time, you get a bit better. The funny thing was that I learned violin in a country where violin playing is not what kids do. Kids will learn the piano, some, and most of them will learn the guitar. It's folklore-based.
What was it like for you to grow up in Montevideo in Uruguay as the child of Austrian Jewish immigrants?
Back in those days, I really didn't care. That never played a role in Montevideo because it is a very accepting society. And anyway, I went to school, kindergarten and school, in the German school. So I always had both languages. The issue of being of that background became more apparent and was more a little, let's say, difficult for me when we moved. I was 15, 1973, we moved to Vienna in Austria. And being of that background in Austria, I remember that at the beginning I didn't really understand why does it that happen where my father told me, don't mention that your background is Jewish. Because unfortunately some parts of the Austrian society till this day are anti-Semitic. And he just didn't want me to have to deal with any of these problems.
What was it like for your parents? I mean, they had fled Central Europe. They had fled the Nazi regime barely. And then in the early 70s, not that long after the end of the Holocaust, they went back.
For them, at the beginning of that time, it was not going back. It was just going to a foreign country that they had ties with.
There are
really?
That's what it felt like, do you think?
Back then, I know that. The great thing about the story of my parents, I mean, my parents had 35 years of South America as an experience. It's a very, very long time. And they were cautiously optimistic of what would happen. And my parents definitely were not practicing Jews, for that matter. But still, the fact of going back to a country that was occupied by the Nazis, where horrible things happened to the Jews was put them, especially my dad, in an uneasy mood. Great news is, as years progressed, they really felt we got back to home, and they spent the rest of their lives until their death in Vienna, very happily being there.
What does home mean to you? You've lived all over the world. You've worked all over the world. You speak a bunch of languages. What's home?
Home is where my family is. For me, this notion of this nation is my where I root very, very deeply. I don't have that gene in me. I have a very deeply rooted affection for Uruguay because I was born there. I have an affection for Austria, of course, 38 years. My two older daughters were born there. I had a family. I grew up there. Long story. And I have a deep affection to the United States because this is the country where I gladly live. This is the country where I met my wife. This is the country where two children of mine, my two boys, were born here in Portland.
And yet, I mean, what you're talking about, and it's interesting, I mean, it's worth noting that you're describing a kind of a lack of a national identity, that version of a tribal identity at a time when globally versions of nationalism are getting stronger and stronger, when many people, millions of people around the world are associating more with exactly what you say you don't really have.
Yeah, I look at that globally, and most of the time I don't really understand what's going on. Because, just don't get me wrong, I am a stern supporter of cultural identity. I will always be supportive of keep that identity. But you said global as a word. And for me, the understanding is we are all as humans in this together. And this trends that are separating each other because somebody is Swedish and the other is Mexican, somebody is American, meaning the United States, but somebody else is from, for lack of better, Venezuela. I don't really see that. My question always would be for all these nationalists, okay, then you get, I mean, Spain as an example. My question, just as an observer, is, okay, and then you have your nation, and then what?
Right, or, I mean, Spain, and then do you divide up that nation?
And I have personal, I prefer if people stay together, and I think that actually the United States are a great example of integrating people from very different backgrounds and different nations here very successfully.
That's the hope.
That is not only the hope. You know, I come, as we talked, from immigration. I have a lot of immigration on my shoulders, and I always looked at the United States as a great example of how immigration actually can work. And then I came to live here, and I love the fact that I go to the supermarket and the cashier comes from some country in Africa. I go to the doctor. The doctor might be of Indian roots. There are Asians everywhere. The entire scope is here, and for my perception, the entire scope has always worked well, and I hope very much that it will work very well in the future. However, of course, I understand there are issues with all of these, and that is why we at the Oregon Symphony created this series called Sounds of Home, and why we are dedicating this weekend's concert to immigration, because through our art form, which is classical music, we want to create a safe platform for dialogue.
Do you see the concert tomorrow night, this weekend, and the others as political statements?
I don't. Political statements always means, at least to me, you take a side.
Mm. You have a point of view.
And our point of view is come to the concert. Listen to what is presented to you. The focal point of the concert actually is like society, very diverse. And maybe through the power of music, since music is a language, we are going to be able to give you a safe haven so you can continue the discussion. Matter of fact, the discussion about immigration has been going on for quite a while, and it will go past this concert. But as you very well know, discussions by spoken words have become increasingly difficult and controversial. Now, if you add to that just the fact that it's music and it's a language and it will show diversity, maybe that helps everybody to have a good discussion.
I want to play one more song. This is something that I assume all of our listeners are very familiar with. This is the beginning of Rhapsody in Blue. This is a version conducted by Zubin Mehta, the New York Philharmonic. Why include this in a series about immigration?
Because Gershwin is an immigrant, same as pretty much all the other composers. And this is also a piece that everybody can recognize. As you said, you all on the radio will know this piece. And we needed that type of anchor because we want to be very, very inclusive at the Oregon Symphony.
You have to think about that as a programmer. You can't just have slightly more obscure pieces or world premieres. You have to get people in the seats with something that they know and love already?
Sure, but since we are talking immigration, for me, immigration is not only a bunch of obscure stories. My own story as an immigrant is actually no obscurity aside from where my parents come from, but I emigrated very positively from Uruguay to Europe and then came to the United States and live happily ever after.
Carlos Kalmar, thank you so much for coming in, bringing us some music and bringing us more of your story. I look forward to talking again.
Thank you very much.
That's Carlos Kalmar. He is the music director of the Oregon Symphony. And as I mentioned, this first concert in the Sounds of Home series is tomorrow. We're going to end today with some listener feedback to a few of our recent shows. Senior producer Allison Frost joins me now. Hey, Allison.
Hey, Dave. Well, a lot of people got in touch with us about our segment on changes in the recycling market last week. Stephanie Brockman said, I've known people who purposefully put things in the recycling bin that they wish could be recycled, thinking that somehow a message would get across. However, I'm pretty sure the people who get paid to sort and process the recycling are not the people who can make decisions about what can be recycled.
Stephen Hames wrote in on our Facebook page to say recycling is neither profitable nor environmentally friendly.
And Henrik Bothy has an idea for a protest. He says that until stores switch from plastic egg cartons back to cardboard, he's going to bring all of his clamshells back to the store where he bought them. Quote, I will leave them in a shopping cart with a friendly note. As far as I am concerned, it will then become their problem and they will implement a solution much faster.
We got some nice comments about the latest installment of our On the Road series. We spent a day riding the number 4 TriMet bus from St. John's down to Gresham, talking to people that we met along the way.
Stephen Vertolve reflected a lot of the reasons why we chose the number 4. He describes it as a very interesting bus route and says, riding it reveals the different residents of the segments of Stumptown, the very vocal PCC students on Albina, the evolving variety in St. John's, the cross-section on Division, and then Gresham. It can get frustratingly crowded. Fortunately, he says, the buses tend to run about every 15 minutes and the drivers are usually patient and helpful.
We also got some responses to our discussion about sexual harassment in Salem on Friday's News Roundtable. Andy wrote, I don't mean to imply that there is some kind of widespread double standard, but as a male working in a majority female office, I get touched all the time by managers, partners, and coworkers. I get shoulder rubs, back pats, side hugs, and just yesterday, a partner leaned in to whisper something in my ear during a meeting, pressing her breasts firmly against my shoulder, causing me to move away to avoid an appearance of impropriety. I don't believe any of this touching is intended to be sexual, yet it still makes me uncomfortable, and because I am male, I'm very careful not to reciprocate.
Elle Taylor also responded to that discussion. She wrote, men in power at the Capitol should have to listen to an endless loop of women talking about their collective grief after being sexually harassed or assaulted, which, let's face it, that's most of us. It goes on continually from childhood until our older years. I'm 60, and it still happens on a regular basis when I'm just walking down the street shrouded in Oregon rain gear. Only men can make it stop.
We welcome your comments, your questions, your criticism, your personal stories. Anytime you can email us, we are thinkoutloud@opb.org. On Twitter and on Facebook, we are @OPBTOL. Thanks, Al.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Tomorrow on the show, the filmmaker Cornelia Swart made a documentary about gentrification in North and Northeast Portland 15 years ago. He returned to the topic because one of his original subjects, a woman who once said, bring gentrification on, decided that she had had enough. If you don't want to miss any of our shows, you can listen on the NPR One app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our nightly rebroadcast is at 8 p.m. A final note before we go, I'm going to be off for the rest of the month or so on paternity leave. While I am dealing with a new baby that is most likely about to arrive, the show is going to continue with great substitute hosts, Allison Frost, Conrad Wilson, Jeff Norcross, and April Bayer. I am Dave Miller. I will see you in December.
Support for Think Out Loud is provided by the Rose E. Tucker Charitable Trust and Ray and Marilyn Johnson,